Hi there, and welcome to Healing at Last, the podcast. Healing at Last is the roadmap to uncovering what happened inside you as a result of the pain of your past. How to find it, how to heal it, and how to move beyond it. So let's get started. Hello, 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 and welcome to the podcast. Don't ask me what episode it is. I have no idea. I hope that when you arrived at the podcast that you can see the episode number at the beginning. I think this might be 10. I think I was told this is 10 in series 3. So welcome. If that's right, I'm delighted with myself. It might be wrong, but welcome. So as you all know, for those of you that attend this podcast, we are all about shedding light on that is within, shedding light on the emotional and mental turmoil that we experience within, and normalizing it, making it okay. And today is no exception to that intention. Today we have the very lovely Leona O'Neill, who I have just met prior to this podcast, and we could have actually just not done the podcast and just hung out and talked about the world and dairy accents and all sorts of things in between. So we're not going to do that. We're going to bring our intention to bear. And so Leona is going to join us in the podcast and have a good talk about PTSD, talk about mental health, emotional health within her field of journalism. So Leona is a well-known broadcaster, a well-known journalist, is now, if I'm right, Leona, and you will correct me, is now teaching this stuff at the University of Ulster, I think. Am I right?
Yeah. I'm head of undergraduate journalism at Ulster University, yeah.
There we go. And also a TED Talk.
Yes. Since last
just
week.
Recently.
Yeah, just recently crowned TED Talk Queen.
TED Talk Queen with the best dairy accent, although I think I might outdo her with a dairy accent business. So we share that commonality, myself and Leona. We took the TED Talk stage to talk very openly and honestly about what it is to be in emotional and mental difficulty. So we have that commonality. But Leona has an entire story, which I think is so worth sharing. And I'm going to leave it straight over to Leona. So if I haven't introduced you properly, Leona, you tell me, right? And add to that. But tell us about your own story. Tell us about your own journey with PTSD.
Yeah, so hello everybody, firstly. So I have been a journalist for 25 years. I think it actually is 25 years because it was coming up to the Good Friday Agreement being signed when I first started in journalism. And I worked in Belfast, I worked in Derry, I worked all over Northern Ireland. And at the now, as we speak, I'm the head of undergraduate journalism at Ulster University. But before that, I was a Belfast Telegraph journalist. I read a column in the Irish News. I'm a field producer for Al Jazeera. I'm working with them now this weekend. And also Vice News and various other. I was an editor in magazines and ran online news portals and stuff. But journalism, I always wanted to be a journalist since I was a wee girl. And I got into that field, loved the job, absolutely loved it. I had no fear in the job as well, which was quite a strange thing, I suppose, but it's a trait that journalists tend to have. You know, you go straight into something with any kind of situation. I would have been at riots, I would have been at rallies, I would have met presidents and politicians and murderers and pop stars and all those type of things, and I would have done it without fear or favour. And so I 4 years ago I was covering a riot in Craigan, and I've been to so many riots over the years. It wasn't anything different. It was kind of just, you know, it's the usual choreography. It was people throwing petrol bombs and you know, burning vehicles and whatnot. So I was covering for the Belfast Telegraph, and so I was just filing copy. I was working from my mobile phone, so just filing copy. And I would always take care out of these things because we did safety training and stuff too, to take cover and stuff like that. But at around 11 o'clock, I was talking to people around the area as well. And I've, you know, just the police were there, and there was petrol bombs being thrown, fireworks going off. It was the usual kind of stuff that happens at riots. But at 11 o'clock anyway, a dissident Republican gunman fired just indiscriminately up the street, and I had to run, and bullets were kind of ripping through the air past my head. And One of the bullets hit Lear McKee, who was just standing in front of me, and she fell, and we tried to help. At that moment, I put down my phone as a journalist, and I was just a human being. I phoned an ambulance. My friend put his coat under her head. We tried to help as best we could, but she died. And I remember just standing there in the aftermath of that, when the police officers had put her into the back of the Land Rover, and I just remember standing there, and there was fireworks still going off because people didn't realise what had happened, and they were still firing fireworks up the street, and there's petrol bombs still coming. I remember the sirens and the Land Rover just driving away, and this feeling, I don't know what it was like, a coldness kind of just, I don't know, just seeped in. And it was like this raw feeling of, I can't even describe it, but someone came over to me, they talk, they say what happened or whatever. It was a friend of mine, he was a cameraman, and he went to get batteries, and I couldn't even find the words. My brain had just, what I had just seen had done something to my brain, and I could not speak. And he was talking, I could see his lips moving, but I couldn't understand what he was saying. And I went home, it must have been the adrenaline wore off, but I was shaking and I was in the car, but I couldn't go into the house. And I was sat outside my car literally for about 4 or 5 hours, because I didn't want to go into the house and be like a human being, not a journalist anymore, because you're safe as a journalist. You're kind of this emotional barrier, nothing touches you, and you're in professional mode, and you're not emotional, you're not anything, nothing, things bounce off you. And I knew as soon as I went into the house, and I've seen my kids lying on their beds and totally peaceful, and not realizing that their mommy might not have come home firstly. That was kind of, one of those bullets could have hit me, but also just that I had seen someone, that the worst kind of humanity, the worst kind of brutal actions of someone had just taken someone's life. And I really struggled with that over the next couple of days, that just, I couldn't sleep. I tried to stay in reporter mode. I was such an internal struggle, and I didn't realize until I actually went to counseling, but it was such an internal struggle. I wanted to stay in this reporter mode because nothing could touch me there. But then I was at home.
If you just didn't mind me interrupting.
Sure, go ahead.
I love that. I love the way that you put that. There was safety in being a journalist.
Yeah.
There was some level of protection from that was within. But the minute that you step outside that, the minute you go home to your family, the minute you become mammy, the minute you become wife, the minute you become anything less than, or else rather than less than this professional role, then you're available to that is within, and that is what you have to protect.
I know. And it was such a struggle. And I really struggled with that. And over the next couple of days, I now realize there were trauma responses. But again, I just felt totally numb. And I would be meeting people. I met someone the next day, or people the next day, who were at the vigil for Lear, and they were crying their eyes out. And I couldn't cry. I could not cry. I could not feel anything except horror. I just felt horror, this kind of like this veil of horror just landed on me and just wouldn't go away. And I remember not remembering to eat. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't be normal. I wanted so badly to be normal again, for this feeling to go away. It was stopping me from doing my job. It was stopping me from sleeping. It was stopping me from everything. And I just remember being at the funeral as well, and just sitting there staring at this poor girl's coffin and right in front of me, because I was in the press pack in the funeral as well. I covered the funeral. I mean, now when I think back on it, I just wanted to keep going as a journalist to save myself, as you say, from that, the impact of whatever that was coming from within, seeing someone, another human being, be brutally murdered. I didn't want to deal with it, so I ran as far away as possible from it, and I worked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and to the point of exhaustion.
That seems sensible in that, because if that's your protection, then you're going to stay as close to that protection as you possibly can. But you're already, the way that you describe it's just incredible. This cloak, this feeling of horror, so you're already in semi-contact. You're in semi-contact with that is within, but trying your best to say. And I think people listening to this, Leona, will so, you know, not journalists, they're not out covering war zones, which is effectively what we're talking about. We can normalize riots all we want, but you're effectively out covering war zones fundamentally. But I think people listening to this will say, I do that too. I protect myself in work. I protect myself in mommy role. I protect my, this is how I cloak. This is how I, you know, drop and roll. And to hear you describe that is just wonderful. And people will be listening to that thinking, yeah, I do that too, just in a different format.
Yeah.
Done that for a while. You stay close to the profession.
Do you know what? I did that for probably a year. I worked myself under the ground. I was so exhausted. I couldn't sleep. I was having really bad night terrors, really bad. I'd wake up in the middle of the night gasping for breath, thinking someone was in the room trying to kill me. And when I did sleep, I had terrible, terrible, vivid nightmares. I still have them the whole time. And it just affected every single part of my life. But what was worse, in the week after, in the days after Lyra was murdered, conspiracy theorists latched onto this tragedy and they started harassing me online. They said that because I had interviewed Nancy Pelosi that morning and I was standing beside Lyra that night, that I was in the Illuminati and that I had Lyra murdered as a sacrifice to Nancy Pelosi. These were like American, because Nancy Pelosi was here visiting. These were American conspiracy theorists and Canadian conspiracy theorists, and they had hundreds of thousands of followers, and those followers just descended on me. And so they're kind of like, you know, sometimes you go online to get a wee bit of solace or to just look through things and try and get away from things or whatever. I literally was trying to run from this, didn't want to sit with it online, trying to look at pictures of people's dinner and then or whatever, you know, you try and escape, some way of escaping the reality. But then these people started attacking me, they started harassing me online, calling for me to be arrested and to be burnt out of my home and for my children to be hurt. They teach me a lesson. And I had to contact the police about a lot of people, and that sort of, and then dissident Republicans also joined in the kind of the in the action, I suppose, and they were harassing me too. And that was horrendous. It was bad enough seeing someone being murdered, but then, you know, people then were threatening violence on me in the days after, when I was already in a state of hypervigilance because of PTSD. And I know now that's what it was, hypervigilance, thinking everybody wanted to sort of do you harm. You've just seen something very brutally kind of played out in your mind, in your eye, in front of your eyes, about, you know, the levels of hate that people can be capable of. And all these people, I mean, there were hundreds and hundreds of notifications, hateful notifications, and I got death threats and I had to go to the police and my house was under watch. It was just absolutely horrendous. And then, so I was dealing with all that. And
I think that's a really important point as well, because here you were witness to something that was horrific. It wasn't you, but your witness. And in that witness, there is these emotions, there's this, the meaning, the interpretation, the inner turmoil, the trauma responses, all that happens within whilst you're there. All of that happens. And for anybody listening to this, this is a normal process of the brain, a normal process of the body. So that happens while you're witnessing someone else whose life has been taken fundamentally. Then you have got that emotional content within. You go home trying to stay away from it as much as you can. But now it's not somebody else's life. It's yours. Now you're being affected. No, and it being directly called out, being directly threatened. Now your own life and the life of your family is now being threatened. And so this is a double trauma. This is a double whammy. Not only did you see it and experience it, but now are you, and we know the way the brain works, and we know the way the mind works. We know when neuroception works. It picks up every threat. So now you're dealing with double trauma, horrific.
It was horrific. And it was kind of, it started off, the conspiracy theorists started off in Canada, but they were spraying stuff, not the conspiracy theorists, but local people here were spraying stuff on the wall about me beside my, you know, beside my son's school or on the walls in Craigan, you know, about trying to discredit me, saying that I would do anything for a story, or that I was an MI5 touting informer and death threats and stuff. And it was kind of, when you're in a state of hypervigilance after seeing something traumatic like that, you do think that everybody means you harm. And then that irrational thought was kind of backed up by the death threats I was getting, by the emails. People email me asking me how my PTSD was and if I've killed myself yet, or people tell me that they're going to slit my throat outside work because I was a horrible person, that I had had Lear McKee killed, or whatever it was that they were saying. I still don't understand what, you know, that people could believe such absolute madness, you know, that some of the, they said it was a false flag, conspiracy says that there said it was a false flag, and we were all actors and liars, and that we were hiding Lyra, and we were keeping her from her family, and people believed, and I just, it boggles my mind. But anyway, that was what it was. But I just remember my brain shutting down, and I don't know if that was a kind of a survival thing. I just remember I was like a robot. I remember the days after that, the day after, actually, the Belfast Telegraph asked me to write a story about what happened the night before, and I could not string a sentence together. I've been doing it for 25 years. I could not, literally could not put one word in front of the other and write a sentence. And when Al Jazeera were here, we filmed for 4 days and four nights. It's quite intense whenever TV crews come over, you spend a lot of time with them and you're filming the entire day. And about 6 months after that happened, my friend, who's a cameraman, he sent me the segment from it because I was looking for it, for something to get a clip out of it. And I don't even remember the reporter that I had spent 4 days and four nights with, very intense. I don't remember what his name was. I didn't remember even what he looked like. He looked like a complete stranger, even though I had spent, you know, almost a week with him. But it was just that my brain had just shut down. And that went on for a year, where I just was an autopilot. I was trying not to feel anything, trying to run away from it. I couldn't even look at a picture of poor Lyra McKee in the paper without crying. And sometimes it just kind of, it springs at you in social media. I just didn't want to know anything about her or about that incident or about court cases. And I was still being a reporter. I was out on the streets and seeing some of the people who maybe would have supported the people who had killed her. And it was awful. And then, you know, people had sent me messages saying that if I came into certain areas, they were going to drag me out of my car and beat me and stuff like that. And it was just like a constant, do you know, when you see whenever something awful happens to you and you go somewhere and you need comfort, you need someone to just wrap their arms around you and kind of go, listen, it's okay, you'll be okay now, you're safe now, or whatever. I didn't get that. Obviously, I got it in my house, but it was kind of, you go somewhere, I need comfort, this awful things happen and they're still poking at you and trying to kind of hurt you and flailing fists and whatever. It was just, there was nowhere to turn. That's what I felt. There was nowhere to turn outside my own home, my own family. Anytime I went outside the door, I felt I was in danger, and it was awful. And that made me sort of not want to go out of the house. That's not a good trait for a journalist to have, not to want to go out of their, you know, into the world.
And what it would do as well, you know, is it would lock you out of yourself.
Yeah.
Fundamentally, because there's a mechanism called emotional wrapping that anybody that listens to this podcast would understand. This the way that we treat ourselves in emotion, the way that we hear ourselves, the way that we soothe ourselves, the way that we, what we tell ourselves about ourselves in the emotion that we're holding. And because the human condition is not want to be in pain, not like being in pain, we have a whole plethora of transgenerational trauma. So when you're in pain as a human being, you're, you know, 9 times out of 10, you're not going to be soothing that, looking at it. You're going to be saying, come on, get up, get on, come on, push on. If you're traumatized, that's not even a conversation that you're having. It's an automatic conversation. It's an internalized conversation. So I just want everybody to understand the breadth of this, because if that happens within the human condition, which I'm sure for you, Leona, was happening, you've got all of this pain, all of this emotion, all of this. And you said it beautifully, you know, these intrusive thoughts, these, and then this worry about yourself. All of that is a process that is happening within. With around that, then there's this kind of, don't go near it, don't touch it, you know, move on. If once you open the box, you're never going to get out of it, you know. And then there's all of these kind of trigger symptoms. Then I want everybody else to understand, you know how hard that is, because most of us love that. That's the reality of what it is to be human. Then you've got this other outer layer of other voices that are agreeing with your own inner voice that tells you that this is, you know, that you deserved it, that whatever that is, that you created it yourself, that you, whatever that energy is. So you have this double whammy of energy, double whammy of negative energy, your own towards yourself and then everybody. And that, dear Lord, Leona, must have been. No wonder you try to stay away from it as much as you could. And how long did you love like that for?
It must have been a year. Genuinely, it must have been a year until lockdown. Like, even, you know, it affected me in ways that even if I went to the shop, I didn't want to go out. I feared everybody. I feared this hypervigilance just was crazy. I went to go to the shop and stand in the grocery shop or whatever, and, you know, someone would stare at me, a man would stare at me, and I think, oh my God, is that the guy who wants to kind of slit my throat, or I'd say my kid's school, sort of, is that the guy who said that he wanted to drive me to my car and beat me? And that went on, and I didn't, to be honest, I thought it was kind of like my new normal. It was kind of like, it was really weird how I absorbed that, and I just kept going, because that's what's ingrained in you in the newsroom as well. And that sort of, you know, as a journalist, you know, you have to keep going, stand tall against all kind of challenges. And it wasn't until it was lockdown. I remember where there was more graffiti went on the wall just about a week before lockdown, and it was a threat. You know, it was like a death threat. And we talked about my family. I just said, listen, I want to move. I want to again run away from it, run and not deal with it, run away from it. It was my kind of modus operandi, I suppose, in those days. And then we had lockdown and everything stopped. So I wasn't able to work 24/7. I wasn't able to run away, escape through my work. I wasn't able to exhaust myself by working 15, 16, 17 hour days and not getting any sleep. Nothing was happening. So we had a lockdown. So I had to sit. And I got COVID. I think it was COVID anyway. So I was sick for 2 weeks. I had to be sort of isolated in my own room. And I had to sit with all that. I had to sit. And that was a kind of flipping heck moment, if you'll pardon the sort of the expression. But I just thought it all hit me. It all hit me at once. And I was sick. And I was sort of in my, you know, having nightmares. And I thought, this is not normal. This is not a normal way for, is this going to be me for the rest of my life? Am I going to be, you know, not able to sleep more than 2 hours a night, or waking up sort of shouting, or just living this kind of life as a zombie? So I decided I have 4 kids to look after. I'm going to seek some help. I'm going to try and get some counseling. And I did that. And it was during the pandemic. So it was online counseling, which was great at the time. It helped me.
It's a place at least you can land.
Yeah.
But I want to take you back to that, because we call that birthing. There's a lot of the birthing process. And there's a lot of people that would recognize that. And I always say trauma is not what happened to you, it's what happens within you as well as what happened to you. And the birthing process is when that material, when there is no escape. You know, I have a similar story in that, a birthing story now, in that the birth of my son brought the birthing of the material within. So it doesn't matter how it births, and it doesn't matter how it comes, but what matters is that you are forced
with it.
You are literally, it's like someone turns you around to yourself and says, now here you are.
I know.
Here it is. Right, Gair, let's have a look at it. And coming, and you ain't getting away. And you, for you, Leona, you couldn't work. Well, you couldn't do what you were doing. You couldn't exhaust yourself. You couldn't put all your energy. Now you're face to face with yourself.
Yeah.
Now you're face to face with what this is inside you. Because the event is long gone. You know, all of that's gone. Now you have to listen to that is within. And that is terrifying, isn't it?
It was a terrifying process. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. I just thought I have really bad sleep. Like, I literally said to the counsellor, I had anxiety when I was in my 20s, and then it kind of went away. It came back. Oh my word, it came back like just... And I thought, I've got anxiety. And the lady was saying, well, what has happened? Well, there was a traumatic experience last year, but that was last year. And it's fine. It's gone. It's whatever. And she was like, I don't think so. And so it was talking therapy. And it was what I needed at the time, because I wasn't ready to sit with myself. I just wanted to feel better. I just wanted to make this go away and let me get on with my work, because I'm a professional journalist and this has stopped me from working. And I wasn't ready, but it served me at the time, where I was able to, as you say, offload sort of what was, and try and make sense of what I was feeling. And it was with a clinical psychologist, actually. And she said, this is PTSD. A year after something has happened, I'm still having nightmares. I'm still having night terrors, terrible hypervigilance, panic attacks, anxiety, avoidance of whatever the, you know, anything to do with the situation, and just all the different kind of symptoms that I had. So this is PTSD. You have PTSD. And I was like, whoa, flipping hell. I just thought that I thought I had a wee bit of insomnia, and I just had bad dreams. I had no understanding of it whatsoever. And I just thought it was maybe a wee bit of anxiety or whatever, but it literally was consuming my entire life. And it was, so her kind of the talking therapy once a week was good. It took me sort of over that time where I literally at that stage felt I couldn't cope anymore, and sort of I can't cope with this lack of sleep. I need to get some help. There's bound to be something that can help me with this.
But isn't that a brilliant that your identification with that was going on was still an external problem. It's a sleeping problem. It's a problem that's not really within. So COVID pushes you to that place where you say, yeah, you can't live like this. Then you reach out and have some sort of answer, and there's some resolution, there's some sort of soothing happening for the first time. Somebody's understanding,
yeah,
that this thing a year ago has caused you pain now. And for many people listening to this, this thing 20 years ago, this thing 30 years ago, this thing 40 years ago, this right. thing that you've actually forgotten, this thing that is no longer etched in your memory can still be with you.
100%, yeah.
And still be bursting through your body. And that, you know, we talk about intrusive thoughts. We talk about, you know, hypervigilance. These are all the wounds of the past asking themselves to be heard through ye.
That's
and
right.
Sometimes they don't ask nicely.
No.
Sometimes they take you by the throat and say, you will listen.
This is it. It just slammed me, and I just thought, oh my word, what is this? But one of the good things about it was she was able to tell me, right, see this, the night terrors, that's because of, so I was able to put a label on those things and kind of under, and that was a big help as well. So I stayed with that counselor for, God, it must have been maybe a year and a half or whatever, just every week and then every month and stuff like that. And then I thought I was cured. And I thought, yeah, I'm cured. But I changed things in my life. I was never going to be able to find peace on my own streets because of, suppose it's, you know, because of people still threatening me and stuff like that. So I burnt down that career that I spent my entire life building up. And I joined academia and went into Ulster University, and I found peace there. And it was beautiful. And the kind of, you know, the young people like laughing about, you know, laughing in the class. And I would just sit and listen to them sometimes and think, oh my God, this is like lovely. This is beautiful. And, you know, my last job was very toxic kind of environment. And you're dealing with the worst type of sort of kind of humanity, and you're in court cases hearing about horrible things happening to people or inquests or whatnot. And this was just a beautiful environment, and that was part of my healing. But I did think I was cured, but I wasn't.
It triggered as much because you had allowed yourself not to rehearing stories that would maybe trigger you. So you closed that door and go on to some sort of level of kind of peace because you were hearing laughter, you were hearing joy, you were hearing the youth of tomorrow thinking about careers. There was a bit of peace in that, and you had kind of stopped the constant triggers that were coming from your previous role. And there's a wee bit of peace.
There was a wee bit of peace there, but there was still, it was like the specter kind of just always follow me around. This kind of, because it's a very recent case, there were always court cases coming up. There's always reminders of it. So I would go sort of for a couple of weeks being fine, and then there'd be a court case come up and it reminded, and then the pictures of poor Lyra would be in the paper and stuff. And then it would kind of trigger me again. I would have to start to have the nightmares and stuff. And then it was around this time last year, or maybe a wee bit later in the year, I started to get really, really bad anxiety, really debilitating anxiety, where I couldn't even drive to work without listening to a podcast about how to deal with panic attacks, breathing exercises. I would have panic attacks during class and say to the guys, listen, I'm just going in about here a second, just going to go to the bathroom, and be hyperventilating in the bathroom. And that just wasn't me. It was kind of like, I was this real tough journalist, and this, what had happened just reduced me to this kind of shell of a person, where I was trying to keep going and, you know, being knocked down and getting back up again. And going ahead and running ahead and then being knocked down by something. And then just at this, I think just at the maybe in the middle of last year, I just thought, like, this is unbelievable anxiety. It was nonstop every day. I was having 3 or 4 panic attacks a day. I was being asked to do kind of talking events, you know, like going panel discussions. And I said no, because I thought, I'm going to have a panic attack during this, or I'm going to start to hyperventilate. And that wasn't me. And I just stripped again. It was kind of felt like me was being stripped away, and my confident me and strong me that was before all this happened had been taken away again. And it's just like, I would be looking at other people and thinking, I'm sure this is, you know, something that other people that have trauma look as well. They look at other people and think, you're so lucky that you don't have to live with this stuff, and you don't always have this kind of shadow hanging over you, or the specter kind of following you around of the horrible thing that happened. Because I would still be thinking about it constantly, or still be reminded about it constantly, or it would just come into my mind when I'm doing something very mundane, you know, like a flashback or whatever it would be called. And but yeah, I went to the doctors, and I just thought, I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm so anxious all the time. Literally, I'm so anxious. I can't drive to work. I'm anxious about driving to work. I started to get a health anxiety out of it. And it was kind of, what if I faint while I'm teaching class? I teach class 5 days a week sometimes in front of hundreds of people. What if I faint? I'm like, you know, it's a totally irrational. I don't think I've ever fainted in my life. I started getting these I didn't know what it was actually, but when you start to panic, my breathing would get very shallow. I have asthma, so I would immediately think, I would go to kind of catastrophe mode and think, right, I'm having an asthma attack. So my head was constantly, and I would get palpitations, and I would think, right, there's something desperately wrong with my heart. I would go to the worst case scenario. And I think it was because obviously what had happened, a trauma had triggered something in me or whatever, but also being a journalist, you're doing stories with people who have died from every single scenario that you could possibly think of. And you're familiar with that story. Someone cuts their finger, gets sepsis, dies. Someone gets their, you know, hand cut in a lift or whatever, dies or whatever. And so I went to the doctor, and they said, well, it's obviously, you know, PTSD or whatever. And do you want tablets? And no, I don't want tablets. I would like to try other, you know, if there's anything else, because nothing had worked in the past as well with this. And I just wanted it to be gone. I wanted to be normal again. So they put me on a CBT.
You again. Back to
me,
you.
Me again. I wanted just to be me again. I wanted to be this kind of strong, confident woman that had been like for years. That's what I was like. And so I went to a cognitive behavioral therapy course. And to be honest, I didn't think it would work. Because I when I was doing counseling, I wasn't ready to sit with any of that stuff. I just wanted someone to come in and wave their magic wand and make me better.
Yeah. And yeah. Take it all away from me and put you
take
back
it all away. Take this.
I think
all
that's this. So normal. I think yeah. You know, when I listen to this, I say, yeah, is that not what therapy is? Is the therapist not the magic? Are they not the magician? And the reality of it is no, they're not. All you are as a therapist is a facilitator. The power is in the client's hands. So the power gets handed to you, Fiona.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. So I kind of went into the CBT, not even knowing what it was. I just heard a friend of mine had said that they had done it and it really worked for them. And so I thought, I literally will try anything. I have tried everything so far. So this is kind of last ditch thing to sort of help me, or else I'm going to just feel like this for the rest of my life. So I went to CBT, and I actually told the therapist, this is nothing to do with Lear McKee or anything like that. This is just, I've just out of the blue developed a health anxiety or an anxiety problem with everything. I catastrophize everything, but it's nothing to do with that because I've dealt with that. And she's kind of like, okay.
Let's see what we got.
let's take this apart. And yes. Over the weeks that I was with her, she just kind of like, she looked just like unpeeled like an onion. Yes. and sat with me while I sat with all that really horrible stuff. And there were times that I went in there and I cried my eyes out. And I can't, I'm a person who can't cry as well. I find it difficult to cry. I find it really difficult to cry in front of people. It's kind of a, I don't know what it is. It's a, I don't know what it is, but And it was really, really tough, really tough. And there were some days I went out of there and I was just a mess. And I used to laugh. We used to laugh, myself and the therapist, because my mascara would be down my face and I'd have to go to a meeting. And then I'd say to her, oh, don't be making me cry this week, because, and she was like, look, it is what it is. We're going to do the work and we have to do it together. And I would have to cancel some of the meetings afterwards. But she sat with me while I sat with this stuff. And it was so powerful. It was so, I would say there, it's like voodoo. It's like some kind of magic, whatever she did. And she said it was me that did it, but I would say that it was her. She guided me on this journey because I wasn't ready. I wasn't ready before to do any of this stuff. But I was at the point where I cannot feel like this for the rest of my life. This is awful. I feel awful. It's affecting everything in my life. It's affecting my work. It's affecting my confidence, affecting my family. I need something to help. And see, by the time that we were finished, my God, it was like you say, reborn. It was, yeah, like,
it is. For anybody that's listening, and we don't want to give names away, but this particular therapist did, whilst they're CBT trained, they did our, what we call the diamond model, the diamond anxiety model and the clear method. And that model is different from CBT in that what this model will ask of the client is they sit in the heart of the material that is causing the anxiety, that the anxiety is but a symptom. And it's a symptom of the unresolved emotional, psychological material that is within. And once we sit in the heart, and Leona says that about 3 or 4 times beautifully, you know, sit with, sit and sit close to. She sat with me. We sat there together. I cried. Because all of the stuff that we talk about, all of the intrusive thoughts, all of the physiological side of the anxiety, the palpitations that Leona's beautifully talked about, you know, the panic attacks, the catastrophizing of what this is going to do, all of that are also just symptoms, which is incredible because there are a hell of a lot of symptoms. But they are all, within our model, they are the symptoms of that lies beneath. And whenever you sit with that lies beneath, which I know is not a very cognitive model, it's a very emotional model. When you sit with that lies beneath and give that a voice and let that be heard and move through that and understand it and reframe it and do whatever you need to do with it, then these symptoms start to dissipate. So within the model, you're never working in the symptoms. You're only working in the material that's creating the symptoms. And that's why we call the diamond model. You're working in root cause. So this amazing therapist was trained to work in root cause. She was trained to work in the body of the material, which is why I love when you say you went done, Luna. And she's like, uh-huh. Let's see where we're going. Because where we're going, you don't think we're going, but that's where we're going.
Exactly.
Beautifully took you there.
She does.
And then you're in the heart of the material. Then you've turned and faced yourself. Then you've turned and faced that is, and the freedom, yeah, is there, isn't it, really?
It really, really was. I mean, she encouraged me to kind of, as you say, sit with the stuff, sit with your fear, sit with your kind of your grief, and for the life lost, and for my own kind of, you know, my own life that was before that was lost. For my courage and all that type of stuff. And I remember one particular session that she said to me, you have to face this stuff. And I was never able to go back up to that place in Craigan where that had happened. And she gave me the courage I didn't tell her I was going to do it anyway. I just left the sort of the session, and I drove up to where it happened. And I just sat there. I just sat in the car and I cried as well. But I cried.
Big stuff.
But she gave me the courage to do that, and then I went back the week after, and I said to her, you know, I have never been able to. 3 years, I have never been able to go one day. I don't even like driving past the area. I don't like being anywhere near it at all. But I went up and I sat there, and she was like, "Flipping hell, you know, that's fantastic." She was encouraging. So then I was kind of, you know, trying to kind of, I don't know what she called it. Was it habitualization or something? Is it, or what's it called? I can't remember what it's called now, but she encouraged me to do, she gave me homework. No, I'm a university lecturer, and I was kind of like, I do not want homework, but she gave me homework every week, which made me kind of sit with it in my own sort of comfort space as well. Right. But I just remember when the sessions were over, and you know, we said our goodbyes and thanked her so much. She literally changed my life. That program just completely changed my life. And I remember
something very important. I really want you to go on what happened after. Something very important there for anybody that's listening. When you're able to sit within yourself and do your own inner work, then you can go back and face what was done. And that's the important part here. When you're able to face yourself, because the trauma is not out there, it's in here. And when you're able to face that it is within, then the bravery that you're talking about, the courage, then you can go back and face that happened. But you can't do one without the other.
Oh, that's so true.
You would really traumatize yourself to go back to those places and try and be okay with that if you weren't okay with them. So it's really amazing transformational trauma on your
brilliant
part. Well, really brave and brilliant.
Well, she I would say she was an angel just that helped me on this, because I would never have been able to do that by myself. I would have still been, although I do still get upset about some things, but I wasn't able to talk about any of this stuff outside the therapy room or you know, anything. I wasn't able to. I would always change the subject. I don't want to sit with it. I don't want to go anywhere near it. It's kind of, it was always revolving around me, and she was able to help me just sit in the middle of that and sit with your pain. I suppose that's maybe what it was. Sit with your pain. And it's hard. It was so hard, and it was dark, and there were some weeks that I left there. I didn't feel, I thought, oh my God, this is awful. But you feel worse before you get better almost.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of, you know, sitting with that is really, really tough. But if you don't sit with it, it'll still spin around you constantly. It'll revolve around you constantly and do you damage. And I felt so much better after I did that. I felt so much lighter. And as I say, I was, because I would have, it was all consuming. This kind of thing that happened was all consuming for 4 years, almost 4 years now. And I just remember getting the train, my car had broken down. I had to get the train to work. And I had music in my ears. I was looking out, and it was a beautiful sunny day. And I was looking out at the beach in Castle Rock, and I felt joy.
Yes.
I was kind of, holy smokes, what is this? What is this feeling? Yeah. It's kind of like it's a joyous, light, positive feeling. And it was a completely alien to me for a very, very long time. And I kind of thought, right, so there's something working. This girl's doing something, some kind of magic. But I feel. And it was almost like a strange feeling. It was kind of, you know, this is going to be taken away from me. This is going to be whatever. But it didn't. It stayed, and it settled with me. And it was kind of like that feeling that came over me that night, that kind of horrible, cold, raw feeling that kind of descends upon you and settles within your soul, I suppose. It was melting that, and it was kind of, you know, helping me feel better.
But it's brilliant, because that is the process. That is the alchemy of pain. That is the process of the alchemy of pain. And I'm no stranger to that personally as well. You know, that when we're with the pain within, there is bringing awareness to the pain within, and then bringing transformation to the pain within alchemizes that pain. And then when it alchemizes that pain, it's, you know, what it does is it allows room for that is natural within you, which is joy and your own self, then that starts to make a bigger appearance. And it feels like one is usurping the other, but what happens is the closer you are to that pain, which is the opposite of what the human condition wants you to do, because it wants you to do what you've been doing, which is run, stay away. So every inch of you, and also society, you know, we'll talk about that. Society, our job roles teaches us to stay away. It teaches us to manage us. It teaches us to manage just the symptoms. It teaches us to eat it, to drink it, to avoid it, to not talk about it. And certainly within your world, I mean, you weren't allowed to talk about this stuff. It wasn't you weren't allowed to, but it wasn't the culture.
No, it's a taboo subject in the newsroom for sure. It's, you know, we don't talk. We're tough, we're hard nosed. We kind of aren't impacted by anything, no matter what. And we're sent into these environments where the worst things have happened to human beings, and we have to record every single minute detail, but we're not allowed to let it impact us.
So there you are doing what, and this is when we talk about bravery, and I know we would finish your TED talk, because your TED talk was that, right? Because there's a beautiful kind of end story to this. You know, the girl that couldn't talk about the care, you, Leona that couldn't turn to it, Leona that culturally couldn't turn to it for all it was, you know, because of the role that you played, all of you turn, you then find a way to turn in that, to alchemize it, the you know, to get rid of it out of your body, to get rid of it out of your mind, so all these symptoms stop, the joy returns. And I understand life is life, you know, you still have family, you still have, you know, children, and you still have children that are sick. That's how we started chatting. We were chatting for a while before about life. Life happens, but that joy starts to permeate your existence, starts to become the central place. So you've done the almighty. You've gone against your human conditioning, which tells you to stay away. You've gone against your industry standard, which tells you to be tough. You've gone against your transgenerational trauma's understanding of you don't feel, we don't feel here, we just do, we get on with the job. You have done, you've gone against most of the training, you've gone against everything and turned in and turned towards it and solved it from that place. I mean, it's bravery beyond bravery, isn't it?
It is, I suppose. It's not, I wouldn't see it as bravery. I just see it as I wanted to feel good again. I wanted to live life again. And I wasn't able to, this kind of just suffocating, whatever it was, a suffocating anxiety or suffocating PTSD, whatever it was stopping me from living life. And I needed to, I am a fighter. That's all through my life. Nothing knocks me down. But this broke me. This really broke me. And I needed to really build myself back up again. And I was through the help of people like my therapist, who put the pieces back together again and gave me courage and strength. And I'll be forever grateful for them for that. I don't see it really as, maybe I am, but I don't know.
We are brave. It's brave. It's brave to face that is within, but we're all brave, right?
Yeah.
Every single person that turns to themselves.
Yeah.
Turns within and looks at whatever that darkness, whatever that, for whatever reason. And there's also a fallacy in trauma care that it has to be newsworthy for it to be traumatizing. And for anybody listening to this, it does not have to be newsworthy either. You can have something that can be traumatizing enough for you to have the same impact that Leona's talking about. So we're not going after the big newsworthy stuff. What we're saying is, if it's important enough to you, if it has created that depth of pain in you, then it is worthy of turning in. It's worthy of going to get it sorted. It's worthy of the, but it takes bravery. It is brave to turn to the pain. And it's brave because your human nature doesn't want you to do it. It tells you not to. And never mind your culture. And I know there's loads of people from loads of different cultures listening to this. Never mind your culture. You know, never mind your family system. The human condition will stop you from turning in. And when you turn towards your brave, and I don't care what kind of bravery, but it's a bravery and courage award that we all need, turning in. And congratulations. And that ended up on just, we'll finish now, right? Because I think we could be here for years. As is Leona. Well, it'll all be, we'll be about 30 minutes. No, we're not. We're like 45 minutes on. We still be here, right? But from the girl that couldn't turn towards herself, the girl that couldn't turn in, that was trying to run away, that was trying to keep it away, turns in. Leona that couldn't speak about it, the girl that couldn't speak about it, the girl that couldn't even look at it, couldn't look at any newsreels from, couldn't. Then does what? Then stands on a bloody TED Talk stage.
I know. So I was with my therapist for a couple of weeks, and she was helping me to talk about this and the whole process and all of the process, what had happened and stuff. And about maybe 3 weeks before I finished, I felt stronger, and I felt that kind of joy, and I felt the lightness coming into my life again after being through that kind of, like, the, I suppose she helped me walk through this darkness, this kind of storm. She held my hand through that, and we were coming out the other side, and we could see the sunshine. And so I was asked to do this TED Talk, and I was like, oh. And she just said, look, you know, do it. She gave me back my voice. She gave me back my courage. I worked on it as well, but without her, I wouldn't have been able to do that. And from someone, as you say, who I could not speak, I could barely say that poor girl's name, but they stand up and talk about what had happened. I spoke about her. I spoke about the PTSD journey, telling people, you know, stand there thinking, I have no shame. I have no shame in being broken. I went and I helped myself heal and got healing from other people. And I was able to stand there and talk for 15 minutes without crying, without kind of breaking down, without kind of losing my voice, and tell people about how I'm using that newly returned voice to help other people in the newsroom, to make change in newsrooms, to make newsrooms better, because we are a traditionally dysfunctional environment, the newsroom. And I want to change that so that there's support there for journalists, because we are human. We're not robots. We're not machines. And I want us to be treated in that way. So it was such a transformation. And it was because of the CBT and because of that program that I did, I would never have been able to stand up and talk. I couldn't even speak to those closest to me about what had happened, because it was just too painful to sit with. But because I did that and I sat with that pain, I sat and I walked through the storm, I came out the other side. And it was such a, I'm not saying it was an easy journey, it wasn't an easy journey, but it was so worthwhile. It was so worthwhile. And it has given me back my life, it's given me back my zest for life. I'm enthusiastic, sickeningly enthusiastic about my, you know, some of the stuff that I'm doing. And it's given me back my courage, because as a reporter who was completely fearless, that was one of the big sort of sore things, that, you know, losing my courage. But I've got that back now, and I've got my voice back, and I'm not going to shut up about it.
Yes. So, yay. And I am a beneficiary of that today in this podcast, and everybody listening is the beneficiary of your voice and your courage and your the freedom to express. And hopefully this will help, you know, thousands of people that may have been on that similar journey in terms of PTSD or a similar journey in terms of anxiety, realize that there is a way out. And that hope then is the transformational seed, the hope that there's a new way, the hope that there is something. And so I just want to thank you for your honesty and your bravery. And I would be a champion of what you're champion, which is to bring humanity to journalism and the mental health and emotional health, because that is what it is to be human. And I'd certainly be behind that, as champion that. I'm delighted that you've been felt brave enough to share your story here, and I know that it'll help so many other people. And for anybody that's listening to this, the program that we run is called the Anxiety Diamond Model. There, we now have so many fabulous therapists trained. If you're in difficulty, please check the website out. And there are therapists on that website that will be able to help you with some of the stuff that Leona has talked about here. So they are Clear Method anxiety specialists, and they are on the website. The links to the website and all the at the bottom of this podcast for anybody that's been triggered or anybody that feels in the same position or anybody that wants to reach out. There is help there, and that help is available within the Clearer Method. So don't be afraid to reach out with the links below. Once again, thank you, Leona. It was a pleasure,
thank you.
An absolute pleasure. I'm delighted that you will be spreading the news of the alchemy of pain and the possibility of reaching your ass back again. So thank you for your share today.
Thank you, Shauna, for that, for developing that method that literally gave me my life back. So thank you.
Onwards, onwards and upwards.